Welcome to NetFront Presence. I'm Matt DeFrance of the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, joined by Nathan Mills, also of the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. And that's right, the NetFront is back. Obviously, we'll sound a little different right now without Jeff Gordon. He retired after 39 years at the newspaper. But we want you to know that the NetFront still is here. We'll still be around. It just may look a little different. We'll probably have the same discussions about hockey, Nathan and I. But we'll also have interviews. Today, we'll be joined by Doug Armstrong to talk about training camp, to talk about player evaluation, to talk about kind of how he looks at his career and how he kind of looks moving forward to Alexander Steen. So look forward to that later on. We'll take some listener questions in future episodes. So it'll look a little different without Jeff Gordon around, but we'll still be here and we'll still be providing a podcast for the fans out there. So with that, I just wanted to introduce Nathan Mills. And Nathan, what can you tell us about yourself?
Hey, Matt. Thanks for letting me join you on your journey here. I'm really excited to be here. Love hockey, you know, so it's easy to step into this role. Love scrappy guys like Walker and Tucker. So that's kind of where I'm coming from. So let's get into it. Let's do that hockey, as Chance the Rapper says.
Yeah, Brady Shea hasn't recovered from that bit all these years later. No one knows how to say his name anymore. The Blues open the season tomorrow night against Minnesota. They have opening night, and on Monday they announced their opening night roster, 23 men. And to me, not really many surprises. I think if we looked at what we thought it would be 2 months ago, that's what it was 2 days ago. You saw Matthew Joseph, Alexander Texier on the roster. There weren't any prospects on there. You know, they sent Otto Stenberg, Dalibor Dvorsky, Alexander Kostomaki back to Springfield. So you had kind of the expected look up front, even that top line of Buchnevich, Thomas, Snuderud, they stayed intact the whole time. Like, that's, there weren't really any surprises. And then even on the back end, you know, Matthew Kessel didn't have maybe the strongest camp, but unsurprisingly, he's a seventh defenseman over guys like Leo Liu for Hunter Skinner, Theo Lindstein, the last guys that were in camp. So, you know, it wasn't all that surprising to see what the Blues submitted. You know, I think the only thing of note would have been Milan Lucic. His PTO is over, but he's staying in St. Louis to rehab an injury that he suffered during training camp. And we'll see what comes of that. But, you know, to me, not too many surprises.
Yeah, I was thinking last night just about how, you know, we are exactly where we were. You know, Lucic was on the outside looking in and still is. I would like to see the PTO extended once he's healthy and see what he can bring. That physicality on the fourth line especially would be great. But yeah, nobody really seemed to step forward and force a change, which is concerning, but you know, this roster with a couple of small changes looked really great last year. So maybe it's not all that concerning.
Yeah. And with Lucic, I mean, he's a guy who, he's obviously 37 years old. He hasn't played in 2 years. And throughout the preseason camp, I fell into two different categories with him, right? So whenever I heard someone talk about him, whether it be, you know, general manager Doug Armstrong, you know, Coach Jim Montgomery, Captain Braden Schenn, Jake Neighbors, who Lucic lived with, like, everyone spoke in a way that made it seem like he was going to be on this roster. Like, yeah, it was almost a foregone conclusion, right? So my ears, every time I thought about Lucic, said, okay, he's going to make this team. He's going to be in St. Louis. And then my eyes kind of told me a different story during at least the first few weeks of training camp, where, you know, that game in Columbus, I think that first period was not very good, obviously. So that's a tough first impression to leave. And I think things have gotten better since then. You know, that's a lot of rust to knock off then. But even in, you know, the home game against Dallas or the home game against Ottawa, not all that noticeable. Obviously, he had a better game in Chicago. He was pretty noticeable in terms of hits and scoring a goal and keeping pucks alive. So he did have a better finish to preseason for me than he did start to it. But it was just kind of, in my mind, I was just confused a lot of the times because my ears said one thing, my eyes said another thing, you know?
Well, he brings, you know, that physicality that I think is really coming back in a big way in the NHL. I think Montgomery's going to talk about that a little bit later, right? And so, you know, you bring one of the most physical forwards of all time in and give him a shot, and you see him ramp up, right? It starts slow, and you would expect that with that much rust, to your point. Gets better. I think, you know, maybe they ride this PTO for a while, and maybe he gets it together. If he doesn't, what have they lost, really? You know, and maybe that's the hope at the end of the day, that maybe they can find something with him at some point, as long as they've got him, I don't know, tied up. I don't know how you say that.
Yeah, I mean, so I, the way that I understand the midseason PTO is, I was reading through the new CBA, is that, you know, you can have him to a PTO, and then if another team wants to sign him to a contract, you have the right to match it. And now that's my understanding from reading through the CBA. I don't know if there are different versions of it, to be quite honest. Right. But that's kind of how I read it in the newest form of it. And so, yeah, I mean, the physical brands that you talked about, that's something that I spoke to Doug Armstrong later in the episode about. And he mentions that, you know, maybe that's coming back a little bit. I think we see that with Florida the last 2 years and how they've played. They have a, you know, play a pretty heavy forechecking style with a lot of nastiness. And you know, even this past week, their preseason games with Tampa had a lot of nastiness. And, you know, I, it's all in my mind, not about that side of the game for me. I mean, we know that Lucic can do that. Like, that's not a question. Maybe at 37, maybe it's a question of how willing he is to keep doing that. But it's more so the other parts of his game to me. It's, can he skate to keep up with, you know, a guy like Alexei Toropchenko, can he, you know, be as defensively responsible as a guy like Oscar Sundqvist? Can he bring kind of that determination that we see on a shift-to-shift basis as Nathan Walker? You know, even Matthew Joseph and Alexander Texier bring different skills than Milan Lucic. So it's about, to me, it's his overall roundedness of the game that will kind of be the deciding factor. But maybe we won't have to worry about for a little bit as he rehabs in St. Louis from a groin injury that Jim Montgomery said yesterday he shouldn't probably even been playing with during preseason. And, you know, I think
the pushing to make the team through the injury, or
that's probably part of it. You know, just trying to make an impression. He knows he has to win a job. If he sits out for, you know, 2 weeks instead of 4 days, then what does that look like? Because if we look at it from a 30,000 foot view, he's a 37-year-old, hasn't played in 2 years. He got injured during training camp. And even when he was playing 2 years ago, was slightly effective, I think would probably be the best way to put it, if effective at all. So there's a lot of things going against him there. So I'm interested to see where it goes and where we arrive when we get there. And, you know, in the bottom six, there have been changes too. I mean, Oscar Sundqvist, he got injured during practice on Sunday. Doug Armstrong said that he's week to week. And he said, well, week to week means more like a week. So he's going to be missing Thursday's opener against Minnesota and the two games on the road trip.
I love Sonny, though. I can't wait to get that guy back. Like, I know it's only three games, right? But he brings something to the ice for me that really changes the complexion of the team. And I don't just mean like the way they play. I mean, attitude, you know? And so I feel good, you know, three games is fine. But missing him for any longer would be terrible. It is concerning though, that even with him out for a few games here, nobody's really stepped up and grabbed a spot either. It's more the same, right? Even with him missing time here.
Yeah, I think the changes we'll see in the bottom sets. I think before Sundqvist was injured, you would have a third line with Nick Bjugstad on the right wing and Sundqvist centering that fourth line between Toropchenko and Walker. But with Sundqvist out for a little bit, I believe Nick Bjugstad will drop down to that fourth line between Toropchenko and Walker. And then we'll see a guy like Matthew Joseph get a shot on that third line, which yesterday during practice they showed would be Jake Neighbors, Pugh Suter, and Matthew Joseph. And it was a mild surprise because all during training camp, it had been Holloway, Suter, Cairo. They'd just been kind of repping that trio together, getting them used to each other. And suddenly we're 2 days away from the season opener, and boom, there it is. Braden Schenn back between Dylan Holloway and Jordan Kyrou, leaving Pew Suter down to the third line to play with Neighbors and Joseph. So there's been some shuffling between Sundquist injury and Jim Montgomery wanting to reunite Holloway, Schenn, and Kyrou. I mean, last year they were one of the best lines that the Blues had.
Yeah.
In January, they were basically the top line. That was when, you know, Robert Thomas was going through a little bit of a struggle. Pavel Buchnevich was going through a little bit of a struggle. And Holloway, Schenn, Kyrou were basically the ones carrying the load up front. So they put that line together. And honestly, the result is an opening night lineup on Thursday against Minnesota that maybe three of the four lines didn't play together during preseason. You just have that Buchnevich, Thomas, Snuderud line that has stuck together the entire time. And it just makes for a different look.
Yeah, I, excuse me, Montgomery's trios, you know, he's a guy who tinkers with the lineup a little bit, but a lot of times he keeps, you know, the same identity, right? Or tries to keep an identity in a trio, you know? And so you see those lines and, listen, I love Schenn, so having him back up there is no problem for me, and that line looked great last year, and it definitely fits with that. I thought when Suter signed that he would really challenge for that second line spot, and then seeing him do that early in camp, right, kind of seemed like that's where we were headed. I don't know, you know, do you have a sense of how much, you know, maybe Lucic not making the team, certainly Sonny's injury more, how much those might have affected, you know, a lot of times you see a trickle down, right? This kind of seems like a trickle up that might have been affected by that.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how much of that. I think it is probably just looking at, hey, this Schenn line last year was really dynamic for us. They were one of the best ones we had. What can that look like this year? I think it's more of that in my mind than...
If it's that, though, then why not do that throughout camp? Why have Suter there so much early and then make?
Yeah, I mean, they knew what the Schenn line looked like, so they felt like they didn't need to see it during camp. They had all the chemistry from last year. They didn't feel like they needed to see it. Whereas the Suter edition, they said, we don't know what it looks like with Holloway and Kyrou, so let's look at it. So yeah, I mean, I think, you know, that top six right there, somewhat balanced. And I think throughout the year, we're going to see a lot of changes. Like, I remember when I covered Jim Montgomery in Dallas, there were line changes often, like a ton from game to game, from period to period. Yeah. And I remember back then when I covered him in Dallas, the point that he made was, you know, I want guys to be comfortable playing with everyone else in the roster so that when I make a change and it's crunch time and it's playoffs and it's, you know, third period of a tight game, they're not afraid. They know how to play with each other. They know what everything is like. And that's something that he even mentioned yesterday. He said, I guarantee it's going to change. I guarantee it. And we know that it will. Like, these opening night lines aren't going to be set in stone. It's a fun exercise I do every now and then, is when I'll look at previous years' opening night lineups and see just how wild they are, to be quite honest, in comparison to how the season ended, because of injuries, because of call-ups, because of just finding chemistry. Like, let's look at last year's opening night lineup. And this is, of course, under Drew Bannister. And there were some different circumstances. I mean, Sundquist was recovering from a knee injury back then. Brandon Saad didn't open the season with the team because his wife was having another child. So there were some guys missing. But here's what we had. We had Holloway, Thomas, Neighbors on the top line. Texier, Buchnevich, Kyrou. So Buchnevich was still the second line center to start the season last year. Texier in the top six role. Joseph, Schenn, Kapanen. So Kasperi Kapanen was on the team before he got waived. And then we've got Torbchenko, Faxa, Walker. So, you know, the other side of that is Zach Bolduc was a healthy scratch. You had Texier in the top six role. You had Buchnevich as a second line center. You had Kapanen on the roster, who he only lasted, you know, not very long before he was waived. Like, there's a lot that changes from an opening night lineup to the end of the season.
As you talk about that, though, as you go through that lineup, I felt myself going at some parts, you know, right? And then this was, granted, it took some second half magic, right? But this was a playoff team last year with that starting, you know, opening night lineup. So, you know, with Montgomery's, let's say, tendency to tinker and potentially additions, injuries and things, I feel good about where they're headed, right? But yeah, there were some changes there. I thought about, though, as you were saying that, the WTF line, I hadn't thought about those guys in a while. It's going to be the BTW line, the by the way line now.
Yeah, I guess for a little bit. Yeah,
that's
I guess
for a little bit. At least for now. Yeah.
I mean, how does there a Sundqvist acronym in there? Is
it, oh gosh, I don't know.
TSW. Yeah.
STW is like Save the World. That's a Fortnite thing, I think.
Okay. Yeah, I'm not up on my Fortnite, so.
I'm not either, but there was a time. Okay.
All right. Yeah.
But you know, think about that Save the World line. They come in. They you know, last guys, right? They save us. You know, I like that.
Yeah, I don't know. There's I don't
put it on a shirt.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, tell them, send it to the Blues. Put it in the pro shop.
I'm sure they'll see it. They'll see the idea. They got it.
Yeah. So and when I think about just takeaways from training camp, to me, as we talked about, there weren't a lot of surprises. I think, yes, you would have liked someone to grab that third line right wing role a little bit harder, but I think. In the end, in my mind, it was going to be Nick Bjugstad's job to lose, just given his track record. Like, he's not a player that truly fits with the identity of Torpchenko and Walker. He can play right wing. Like, I covered him back in Florida, honestly. Like, this was back in 17, 18 when I was covering Nick Bjugstad in Florida. And that was when he was playing right wing on a line with Alexander Barkov. Like, he's capable of playing right wing on a scoring line back then. Obviously, the career has looked a little different right now, but that wasn't really all that surprising to see him there. The thing that I enjoyed or appreciated seeing in training camp was how much the Blues and how early, I guess, the Blues worked on their power play. I think they would have liked to have seen more in-game power play reps from their guys. But the way that they split up the rosters, they were able to have one unit play together in one game and during a morning skate and during a practice. And then they had the other unit almost completely together on the other side. So, you know, it's something that helps. I mean, last year with Drew Bannister, they didn't put these units together until pretty late. And I think this year the Blues made a concerted effort to get them together early to try to rep them a lot in practice. And obviously they want more reps, but it's not like these groups of players are foreign to each other. I mean, that top unit has Snuggerud at the net front, Thomas in the flank, Shen at the bumper, Buchnevich at the other flank, run by Cam Fowler. And then the other unit they'll have with Neighbors at the net front, Kyrou in the flank, Suter in the bumper, Holloway at the other flank, and Falk running the unit. So they have that Holloway Kyrou connection that has been pretty good. They have kind of the handedness all correct on that top unit. You know, that bumper spot was where Zach Bolduc really made a lot of work last year. He scored a lot of goals from that spot.
Yeah, he had a real breakout there. Yeah.
Yeah. And it worked out because he was left-handed. Like, he had Thomas feeding him from one side as a right-hander. He had Snuggerud at the net front kind of feeding him up into the bumper from the right side. So it worked because he was left-handed, because he wanted to get that one-timer off. And that's what they're looking at Braden Schenn there in that position. And I think we'll also see a lot of interchanging between Thomas and Snuggerud. You know, Thomas kind of provides a little bit more of a passing look, distributing, playmaking on that flank. Snuggerud would be a little bit more of a shooter. He has that one-timer threat from that side. And they give each other, they give the unit different looks depending on where the pressure is coming from. And I think that'll be maybe add a little bit more dynamic look to the power play unit as the season goes on.
Yeah, that's part of what I really took out of training camp is this camp just feels different, right, than in past years. The approach is different. The attitude is different. How much of that do you think, I mean, you've been around the team here and you've been around Montgomery here and in the past, how much of that do you think is Montgomery bringing his style to the team now and his leadership capability.
Yeah, I think in it's part of it. You know, I think that's part of it. You know, this is not a guy who's leaving his first NHL training camp. And you know, no shade to Drew Bannister, but that's what it was last year. Is if someone who was leading his first training camp who kind of I think would get frustrated about the results in training camp. I remember last year they were, you know, they were struggling to open the season to start training camp. They were, you know, 1-4. I think they're 1-4 through 5 games. And that was when he kind of talked to reporters after a game and said, you know, I'm really disappointed that we haven't been able to do more. We've been able to do more. Yeah, and it kind of took me by surprise. And, you know, this year the Blues started 0-3-1, and Montgomery didn't really have a sense of, like, panic's not quite the right word, but consternation. He didn't quite have that. So I think that's part of it, his attitude. I think the other part of it is that the Blues generally know what they have, right? They saw most of these guys last year. You know, the biggest question marks they have are basically Jimmy Snuggerud, and you know, they're giving him a top line role, so they must not have much of a question mark about him.
Yeah.
And Logan Mailloux, who's, you know, played 8 or 9 NHL games, like, they're giving him a full time role in the third pair. So those are the biggest questions that they had in my mind in terms of personnel. Like, they had questions about which spots belong to who, but in terms of what this player looks like, who is he, how can he contribute, they didn't really have that many. So I feel like that's probably why it's a different feeling. And you know, I think the third thing, you know, Jake Neighbors talked about it. He said the last few years there's been questions about are we going to be good? Are we going to be a playoff team? And he said, you know, this year it's about raising the standard, raising that bar and seeing how good we can be. So I think that kind of factors into it, and kind of all those things give it a different feel this year.
Yeah, I love that. That's a great quote.
Yeah, and then even when I talked to Jordan Vinny, says, "Hey, Jake just said this. Is that how you feel?" Like, yeah, we saw what we can do. We know what we can do, and now it's just about doing it for them. You know, I think it's gonna be a tougher division. You know, that the Central looks a little bit tougher, but there's a wide range of possibilities for the Blues for me this year. That's I don't know how you feel about them, but that's how I feel.
Yep. I think they could be. I think they could be an 85-point team. I think they could be a 98-point team. But I'm hoping that they're a 98-point team.
Yeah, like when I look at Dallas and Colorado, like those to me are still the class of the Central Division.
Yep.
Those are teams that you know they're going to be there. But I look at their off seasons, and I don't feel like either one really took a step forward. They didn't have a big addition. They don't have, you know, the prospects come in. I mean, Dallas gets a full year of Mikko Rantanen, I guess, but you know, they had to change up their detour for cap reasons. They had to ship out Mason Marchman for cap reasons. They got some raises kicking in this year between, you know, Jake Ottinger and Wyatt Johnston. You know, there's open questions about Jason Robertson and Thomas Harley being RFAs next year. Like, they have kind of some things to answer. And you know, their team, I don't know if they look all that different besides bringing in Radek Foxa, bringing him back to Dallas to kind of fill that role that he filled in St. Louis last year as a physical fourth liner. You know, look at Colorado, they changed up their bottom six a little bit with Miles Wood and going out, but to me it's still not all that different. You know, they have Brent Burns, but he's going to get, you know, 30 seconds of power play time after McCarr gets done with his. So it's not like you're going to see the full Brent Burns that we've seen in the past. So I looked at Dallas and Colorado. Maybe did they even get better? I don't know.
I think with a little bit of age and stuff, yeah, I think they may have taken a half step back. I think St. Louis is more than a half step behind them, or was more than a half step behind them. So yes, definitely still a clear three, I think. Yeah.
Yeah. And then even Winnipeg, you know, they lost Ehlers, and they do have the reigning MVP in net. So I think that's gotta be worth something to just how good they can be projected to be this season. But I've never really been a big believer in the Jets, to be quite honest.
you and Jets fans alike.
Yeah, it's just, I during the playoffs last year, I know it was when Shifley got hurt, but when they were running out Vladislav Namestnikov as their first line center without Shifley, like that's not really what a contender looks like. And I think a lot of their issues were kind of band-aided over by Connor Hellebuyck being the best goalie in the league last year. So
yeah, they're buoyed by great goaltending. There are a couple of teams that are like that. And I think you saw last year in that, and granted, they were like, again, late season magic, they were on that run. But I think you saw in that playoff series what a team can do when they pressure that goalie, as great as he is, right? When they give, when they put that kind of pressure on anybody, eventually they're going to crack. And, you know, he did.
Yeah. And then, like, that's an open question with him playoff wise, right? And so, I look around the rest of the teams, Minnesota. They're always just the Wild, you know. I think Utah is going to take a big step forward this year. I like what kind of they did. Their goaltending, they can't really ride Kirill Vemelka that hard as they did last year, but they moved to bring in JJ Paterka, and they got a good young group of guys there up front with Keller, Genther, Paterka, kind of leading the charge. And Nashville, I don't think they'll be there. You know, that's a big step to take from 68 points to playoff contention. And obviously, I think we all can agree Chicago's at the bottom. But yeah. I look at this division, I could squint real hard and see the Blues challenging to win it. Mm-hmm. Or I could squint real hard the other way and say they could be in sixth place. You know,
sixth? Oh, I don't know about sixth.
I think it's a wide
range.
How hard
are you squinting? Are you sure?
I mean,
you're not squinting too hard.
It could be, but we look at last year's standings. I mean, they had 96 points. Utah was at 89. Utah was in sixth place at 89 points. And
I guess I didn't realize Utah was that good last year.
Yeah, I mean, you said, you know, maybe you could see the Blues at 85 to 98. I mean, 85 would have been sixth place last year.
Yeah. Okay. So, all right. Well, I don't feel as bad then. Maybe I should squint harder.
And you know, I think that's also a product that maybe the Central is kind of tighter. You know, that the difference from first to sixth may not be that much. Maybe it will, maybe it won't. Who knows? The point is, I think realistically, I see the Blues finishing kind of third place in the division. I think that's a realistic, very possible scenario, given a full year of Montgomery. You know, a full year of Jimmy Snuggerud, of having a deeper lineup, of having a full year of Cam Fowler, of having the confidence from last year. I think there are a lot of factors going in the right direction for the Blues that they can finish in that third spot in the Central Division. You know, the worst case scenarios are if they go the other way, if, you know, what if Holloway and Broberg kind of take a half step back from kind of their first year in St. Louis, because they really don't have a proven track record of doing that year after year after year.
Sure.
You know, what if the defensemen look a little bit older? If Parayko and Fowler and Faulk start to look a little bit older, if the goaltending is around 900 instead of around 905 or something, like there are ways you can see it falling. But I think realistically, I think that they're third place in the Central Division. And a playoff team and better than a lot of teams in the Western Conference, to be quite honest.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. I think they're probably a wild card team. I think they're a dangerous wild card team. You know, I'm not running out and putting money on a Stanley Cup run, but I think that when it comes time for the postseason, there will be teams that do not want to see St. Louis on their side of the bracket. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and I think that was last year too. I mean, I'm sure Winnipeg saw the Blues coming after what they did, and they didn't want to face them. And when they played in St. Louis, they played like they didn't want to be there. When they played in Winnipeg, they played like they wanted to beat the Blues. So, you know, I think I was looking yesterday also. The Blues haven't lost a home game since February 22. They won the last 12 games of the regular season at home. They won all three games in the playoffs against Winnipeg at home. So when they open against Minnesota tomorrow night, there's going to be a little bit on the line in terms of just keeping that streak going. I mean, that's almost 8 months of not losing at home. And I understand there is an off season in there. Yes, the offseason accounts for a lot of that, but
it's
still pretty impressive.
It's all wins to me.
All right, so let's look forward a little bit to the Doug Armstrong interview. Spoke to him after practice on Tuesday, kind of about training camp, about player evaluation. We talked about the expansion of the analytics team, how he views analytics. He talks about disagreements in scouting, how they bridge those gaps. Even looking at training camp this year, about what they gave to the prospects to take to the American League, and spinning it a little forward, how he wants to teach Alexander Steen to do the job that he's doing right now. So with that, we'll turn it over to Doug Armstrong and the interview with on Net Front Presence.
All right, remember, the machine knows if you're lying. First statement, Carvana will give you a real offer on your car all online.
False.
True, actually. You can sell your car in minutes.
False? That's gotta be...
True again. Carvana will pick up your car from your door, or you can drop it off at one of their car vending machines.
Sounds too good to be true, so true.
Finally caught on. Nice job. Honesty isn't just their policy, it's their entire model. Sell your car today, too.
Carvana.
Pickup fees may apply.
We'd like to welcome Doug Armstrong to NetFront Presence. Doug, nice to have you, and welcome the first guest of the NetFront Presence podcast.
Well, thanks for having me on. We appreciate it.
Yeah, and so this will be the first one, and for these interviews, we'd like to go in depth on a certain topic. And so with Doug, we'll talk a little bit about training camp and a lot about player evaluation, which, of course, happens a lot in training camp. So we'll start with training camp. Doug, we spoke to you a little bit earlier about the moves you guys made and everything that's where it stands with Lucic and Sundqvist. So can we just talk about Lucic and where that stands with you guys right now?
Yeah, obviously we brought Lucic in to training camp, and he got injured early in camp, and he's been trying to fight through it. And he's the point now where he just needs time off the ice and rehab. So what we're trying to do is work through that now to see where his, you know, to rehab him here, see if he wants to extend an in-season pro tryout when he gets healthy. And I think he and his wife and his representatives are trying to chart a course with themselves, knowing that that's one of the options.
Yeah, and one thing you mentioned earlier when you met with the group of us was the way that preseason games have gone and the need for a guy like him. I look at the Tampa-Florida games as examples and all of that stuff. Has that kind of changed the way that you view his potential role in the league right now?
I just think that physical hockey seems to be making a return. I think for whatever reason, and it's not just that last game. It was probably the game before that when they were NHL players doing it to NHL players.
Right.
It does get your attention for sure. So it's an area of the game that we're comfortable in. We have players that aren't afraid, the players that can take care of themselves. But sometimes it's always nice to have the meanest guy on the block.
Yeah. And that's something that doesn't always show in the preseason, right? I mean,
I think, you know, when you're Lucha's caliber, young guys want to show respect to him. He doesn't want to play that brand of hockey against someone that's not capable of doing it. It doesn't play itself out for a veteran to do a lot of that. But it's an area of the game where we're not looking for someone that come in and just fights, but someone that can play a physical brand of hockey that can answer when the temperatures get hot. But I think the day of just the guy that just sits on the bench and fights is gone. So what we need to do is make sure we have a capable player that's one of the elements he has.
Yeah, and when we look at training camp overall, what percentage of it do you feel like is player evaluation from your standpoint in the job that you do?
It varies. I think, you know, this team, like the last couple of years, it was a greater evaluation because we were trying to incorporate younger players. We were trying to incorporate a different vision. This year, we seem to be a little bit more established. We have an understanding of some of those players, like the Tuckers, like the Hofers, like the Neighbors that we've seen in the past. So this year was more preparing for the season as it was player evaluation. You obviously want to see how young players are progress year to year, but there was competition here, but there's veteran players. So I think every training camp has a different level. But what we did is watch our younger players. So when we signed them to the American Hockey League, it wasn't just go play, it's play with a plan. And we want to tell them areas of the game that they're succeeding in areas of game that we think they can improve to make sure when they get to the NHL, they're ready to play.
Are you able to share any of those with the young guys, Dvorsky, Sember, Kostomaki?
Yeah, guys? Like a player like Dvorsky, it's playing away from the playing away from the puck. His skill set, his ability to make 10-foot passes is excellent. His ability to make the puck do its magic is high. It's getting in those harder areas and playing through traffic, playing into traffic, playing, you know, closer to contact is something that he has to embrace and learn how to do. And it's not a negative, it's a maturity thing. And so that's just an example. I think you see a player like Stenberg who has excellent two-way ability. It's adding size, it's adding puck protection skills. It's learning how to push the game along at different times. There's a time to take a risk and there's time not to take a risk. And it was funny. So when we talked to Kaskamaki, Jim said the opposite. He says, you play too conservative. At points, you have to take risk in this game. You have to not just be a clock killer. So there's everyone is a little bit different. And what we try and do is pick out things that each player can work on.
And you mentioned earlier about the kind of the style of game changing, where you can't just have a guy that fights. You have to have him be able to do other things. Has the style of the game changed the way you view players as well? I mean, when you have a heavier game coming back, do you kind of weigh things more in one area versus another?
I think you're trying to stay current with the trends in the league. I think it's again, turning into a bigger man's game.
You feel like that was just like because of Florida and what they've been able to do the last few years?
No, I think we played like that way in 2019. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, you had some, you know, sub 6 foot defensemen that were changing the game, whether it was a Hughes or a Makar at 6 feet. And then what I think you find is those guys are the exception, not the norm. And everyone was hoping to find the next 5'11 or 6 foot defenseman that could be those guys, but that they're superstars for a reason. And the one thing you can't teach is size.
Yeah. So when you look at a player, and I mean, I think people don't understand how long the process is for getting to know a player. I mean, it starts when they're up as amateurs, right? Like when you look at the amateur scouting and the pro scouting, and like what are the key skills that you look to? What are the most important things that you find in the whole scouting process?
I think it's hockey sense. I think you have to have an understanding of how the game is played, then skating. But I think if you're just the fastest skater to the wrong spot, you're not going to be helping your team. So I'm a big believer in hockey sense, and then skating, and then obviously physical strength. But there you want that full combination of things. And hockey sense is also slash character. You don't. I always tell a younger player is that you're best to have many different things that you can accomplish in a game. If you're going to be a one-trick pony, then that trick has to be fantastic. And you're better to give yourself a couple of different options. So, but I think hockey sense and character are things that we try and find in players.
And is you're finding hockey sense, is that even accentuated more? Because, you know, you get a lot of skating statistics or analytics from different places, you know what their point totals look like. You understand where, you know, you have other sources of information. But when you have scouts and their eyes, like, is that really like, hey, we need to find hockey sense. Hey, we need to find competitiveness.
Hockey sense to me is being able to affect the game in different ways. You know, having the knowledge of the sport to defend, to attack. To play in your five on five, four on five, different areas, and adapt to what the opposition is giving you. Sometimes you just can't impose your will on the opposition. Yeah. You have to adapt, and I think smart players are willing to do that. And are able to do that.
Like, how many guys make it to the NHL without hockey sense? Like, is it? It feels like a lot of guys. If you make it to the elite level, you have at least.
Well, they're everybody that plays in the NHL has hockey sense, but. When you're comparing that group to just that group, that's where it differentiates. So you have an Adam Oates that's hockey sense was off the charts. His ability to control the game back in the day with his brain, not his feet, his passing skills. Robert Thomas has unreal hockey sense. But you know, you take another player like a Nathan Walker, Torpachenko, they have hockey sense to get to this level. what they need to do is they have to incorporate their hockey sense into the momentum of a game, how to change the direction of the outcome of a game. So hockey sense is also predicated to what you're asking to what you bring to the table.
And it can be kind of a band-aid of sorts too, right? Like I think about, you know, when I was in Dallas, say they had some guys that weren't the best skaters, Jason Robertson or Joe Pavelski, but they thought the game at a high enough level to overcome that. Or if you think the game at a high enough level where you're able to overcome size deficiencies, like it feels like it can be something that can cover for different things too.
Yeah, I think it is. We had a player back, I'm dating myself, was into the 90s, but someone said he couldn't skate, and the manager responded, "Yeah, but he knows where to stand." and that's always stuck with me. You know, if you know where to stand, if you're playing the game, if you're playing chess and they're playing checkers, that's a good spot. And I think you've seen a lot of players stay in the league a long time based on hockey sense.
Yeah. A little bit back to the stylistic standpoint, when you look at players and you understand where the game is going, you know where your roster is, what kind of style you play, are you looking for a player to fit your style or to fit where the game's going or to fit a certain role? Like where's the balance in all of that?
Well, I think it's different depending on who you're talking to on your staff. Our amateur staff is find the best players because what you said earlier, the game would be easier if we had a 20-year-old draft or a 21-year-old draft. You know, a lot of the questions are eliminated. I think when you look at college football, like that is, you know, there's basically a rule of thumb I've been told in football, like your first 5-round picks, they have to play. You've got enough information. They have to make your roster and play. Where in the NHL, at 18, you're hoping that two of the first 5 rounders play in 5 years, not in 5 weeks.
Right.
And so it's a whole different environment on the way you scout and how you have to look at players. And, but yeah, it's a crapshoot when you're taking those young players. Now, if you go to the pro scout and say, this is what our team is missing today, go find us a player that fits that role. It's easier to do. So I think the skill set that scouts have, I think, differentiates on what type of player they're watching.
And what role has analytics kind of brought into the whole player evaluation process? I mean, you've seen it from before when there weren't any, and now, you know, teams are starting to build out staffs and stuff like that. How have the analytics side kind of impacted the way you look at different players?
Well, it went from 0 to 100, and now it's back around 80 and probably working closer to 60 or 70, at least in our organization. I don't want to speak for other organizations. Some live and die in it. But what the analytics can't tell are the things that we talked about earlier. It's hockey sense. It's the size of the heart of the human being, too. And our sport isn't – like if you look at baseball and you look at football, each play lasts – at the maximum 8 seconds, you know, and then everybody stops, there's a whistle, everyone gets organized again and you start, where hockey can go 8 minutes without a whistle. And so it's a little more difficult analytically to put that definition that they can in those two sports. But I think it's important. What we use it do is to stretch our horizons of what we're asked, talking about and thinking about, makes us answer different questions that we might not have asked before. Okay, so this is what the analytics say. Well, define what the analytics means to us, and then why is that fitting in for us, or why isn't it? So to me, it doesn't give us answers, as more makes us ask better questions.
Right. Actually, I've talked to one team that they think that they can quantify hockey sense at some point with their analytics. I don't know how, but they think they can, maybe with predictive of where the puck should go in certain situations, where the player is in certain situations. But as far as you talk about the Blues going from 100 to 80 to 60, what does that look like within the organization?
Well, we were one of the first teams to have analytics. We had Coleman Analytics, and we used it for synergy. We used it for things that were very enlightening. Now we have a 5-person analytic department that give presentations, and I'm not as comfortable with the presentations as a younger generation are. I mean, that's just reality. I wish I had a better understanding of it. I understand the 30,000 foot view of analytics. And I think AI is something that could really revolutionize. And I've talked to our group about that. Like, what would the cost of, you could build the perfect penalty killing unit, and then you could use that as a teaching tool. But to do that, you have to incorporate all those things into a machine. You have to tell them what you think is right. And the reason I got that was I saw last week there's an actress, an AI actress, that's taken over the world right now. And a company's trying to sign her, the creator of it. And when I saw it, she looked like an actress.
Yeah.
And so it got me thinking, well, why can't you have a penalty killing unit as a teaching tool that's all AI created? Mm-hmm. And then they said, you can. It's just you have to then construct the mechanism to do it, which is millions and millions and millions of dollars. But I think it's going to get done. It's going to happen over time.
Yeah, I think I heard somewhere, I was watching a video, an interview from someone with City, the soccer team, and they were looking at AI as a potential way to look at injury and recovery and prevention, and how can they use that in that aspect. So I think you're right. I think AI will impact our roles in different ways, but who knows what it ends up looking like, right?
Well, and we talked about it, like, you know, and I don't know, like AI is taking jobs. They're taking is AI going to take management jobs, coaching jobs? They're not going to take the athletes themselves, you know, but are they going to take the people that put the athletes on the ice, that pick the athletes? How will we do it? I don't know that answer. I'm glad I'm not 20 now and having to deal with that. But I'm fascinated by it, and I'm fascinated to try and learn. I just wish I was a quicker study.
Yeah, and you mentioned your analytics staff. I believe you added 3 members this offseason, right? Just doing some preliminary research on them. I mean, you got a guy from Puttpedia, spent some time at Puttpedia, someone who spent some time at SportLogic, and someone came from an investment banking background, right? Like, why did you want to kind of expand the team? What are their roles? How does that all look like in the organization?
Well, I think when you're, we always try and stay never below the midpoint, you know, and in this game, in any sport, I think if you're following the leader, then you're playing catch up, you know. So what we want to try and do is get as deep as we can into things, and then, you know, it's like our practice rink here, for an example. Like, we built it, I think, in 2018, 2019, and now you look at Utah's and you look at Florida's, and now you got to go back and redo it again. Like, the game is always changing; everything is evolving, and that seems to be evolving at a quicker pace. And so we had Mike Perlman, who heads that department, up. We tasked him with finding the proper people that could give us different information. And I don't know how it's going to work, you know, but we're starting down the process. We're going to see. We'll probably skin our knees along the way. But if you're not trying, you're not giving yourself the best opportunity.
So they have certain projects they work on and things like that.
Yeah, and we're going through that now. Like, we'll throw different ideas at them. And but right now, what they're trying to do is get the foundation built, which is going to take a little bit of time, so we can start the projects.
Yeah, and there's so much data that you guys get from every game, basically all the puck and player tracking data.
Well, yeah, and it's trying to find out what data is useful and what data is useless.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and that's where you need these people to come in and present their case on why that's useful data, and that's why I go to the coach and say, this is useful, use it, or the coach say, this is useless, don't waste my time.
And the numbers may say one thing, the scouting staff may say one thing, even the scouting staff may say 2 or 3 different things, right? They have different eyes, they have different views of players. You're ultimately the general manager. How do you take all of those visions, data points from those people, and kind of marry them into one evaluation that makes a decision?
Well, what we'll do, we'll stay in the amateur side. So yeah, we'll have our amateur guys do their eye test list, and then we'll have the analytic department do their best analytical people, you know. And then, so like 1 year, the number one player, number one in the draft, was like 30th in analytics. That's a massive difference. Yeah. So we dug into why the discrepancy, what points made him so poor analytically, were they giving too much weight to, or what are you seeing with your eyes that you're giving too much weight to that isn't there? And so that's how we use it. We try and marry the two together by pushing each other to answer questions on discrepancies.
And then even from person to person, right? Like, if you and I saw a player differently, obviously I think your opinion here probably matters a little more than mine. But if we did see a different, like if I'm, we're both pro scouts and, you know, we bring a presentation to you about each player, how do you kind of weigh different opinions from your scouting staff? Because I'm sure there's a lot of disagreements. That's why you have many people.
Yeah. And that's why it's, so you have the guys do their reports and send it to you and you read through them. Unfortunately, maybe it's just the type of people that we work with. It never gets that confrontational. You have to push and the guys stay strong to the beliefs, but nobody thinks that they're 100% right all the time. Our game's not built like that, you know. Maybe Connor McDavid, like the obvious ones, but you know the most of the players, they have nuances that there's things that I like in a player that Jim doesn't like as much. And there's things that Jim loves in a player that I don't think are that important. You know, it's what your end product is. And then we debate it and we hash it around and we kick it around and do that with each scout. And we come up with a list. But I think like scouting debate, scout to scout is always interesting because that's our natural fallback position. And then the analysts come in and push it a different way. But the question is, when it's scout to scout, it's just basically, and then it's basically talking about and then supporting your vision on video. Like, okay, just show us the game that you're seeing that. Not a shift, but show us multiple shifts of puck protection skills or not puck protection skills, or, you know, like this guy wins every 50-50 battle at the blue line. This guy loses every 50-50 battle at the blue line. So even if he's producing, you know, there's a reason that we're, so let's say he's your line mate and he loses that battle at the blue line and you're stuck in your zone. Well, your analytics suffer because he didn't get the puck out. So you're trying to use, okay, what's he direct result of his play and what's he sort of sucked into? It's like a plus minus.
Yeah. I mean, there's even some during preseason camp where, you know, there's a bad change here or there and someone gets an unfortunate minus on the stat sheet. But you look at the end of the game, you say, how did he end up minus two? I think he was pretty good. And, you know, I think analytics are a broader view of that where it's not just goals, it's shots or shot attempts or expected goals or whatever. But the concept is similar.
Yeah. So it's marrying all that together.
Yeah. We talked about just kind of the length of time that you would kind of take information on a player, right? So if we look at Broberg and Holloway as examples, can you take us through kind of how much information you have on them from just amateur side to pro scouting side to ultimately kind of the off sheet? Like, how many data points do you configure and how does that kind of affect the decision there?
Well, it's so those players, we would use data points from 18 to 22 and 23 when they got traded for. You know, if you're trading for signing a free agent, let's say, I don't really go back to his junior reports. You know, they're really irrelevant. He's been in the league 5 or 6 years, you know, so you go back to recent history. So I think everyone is different. So Broberg and Holloway went back to, why were they selected where they were? Where did we have them on our list? Were we correct? Were we incorrect? Okay. Now they're in the Edmonton Oilers organization. That team is pushing for Stanley Cups. They're pushing for experienced players. They have a cap. They can't carry this kid on the cap because of the overage. They need a guy making the absolute minimum. How does that affect him? How did he play there? So you're gaining all that information of where they're playing, how they're playing, why they're in that situation, and then you're projecting. And those ones, but we had talked about acquiring those players for a couple of years. It just never, the paths never crossed. You know, when Edmonton started their run, we were starting our rebuild or retool or, you know, and so at the deadlines, they were calling about experienced players and we were honed in on those guys. So it was a culmination of over time, those names kept coming up and then there was just a different way to try and acquire them.
I think I come up with a word for the retool, rebuild, whatever. I think reload.
Reload.
I think that should have been
that is the
from,
new one
from the start. Just reload. I think you tried retrench.
Yeah.
At the very beginning, you said retrench.
Yeah.
I was thinking the other day, retool is like.
That's it. I'm stealing that. Trademark that.
Yeah. Reload kind of has a positive connotation for it. I think you should have gone with that one. And you talked about the wanting the competitiveness, the hockey sense, the character. using Holloway as another example, right? I think we can see in St. Louis the character he has, the hardworking nature to himself. But you said you didn't really know that much about that side of him before the offer sheets. You had to see him in practice. But I mean, I know you guys do a lot of character research on the amateur side. Like, how much do you know about a pro player, his personality and character before they come in?
That's harder to obtain.
Yeah.
It's a pro scout that knows somebody that he played with. You know, what's he like in the gym? Nobody really throws anybody under the bus unless they're like nobody wants to put their reputation on the line for someone they know is bad. We knew Holloway had good character. That had checked up. But what does good character mean? That they're going to fit into your team, that they're not going to be a problem, that they don't have any off-ice issues that anyone's aware of. But then you go to Holloway, when he got here, and as I said, it was eye-opening. Like on Sundays, I would come in here and it's a day off and I hear this clanging in the shooting room and it's him. Like, those are things you just have to live and understand and learn with. There's players here that are in the gym all the time, and there's high character players that are never in the gym. You know, so that's the stuff there's a saying in hockey, or probably in all the sport, you better know what you're giving up, because you really don't know what you're getting. And I do believe that. Like, you think you know what you're getting, but you know way more about the guy you're giving up.
I just want to finish up with a couple, maybe looking back and looking forward. So you credit Bob Clark, Bob Gainey for kind of getting you into the industry. What were your biggest things you took away from them in terms of looking at players and evaluating them?
Well, their philosophy on building a team was more than their evaluation skills that I learned sure. from. It was both captains of Stanley Cup championship teams, both in the top 100, both built teams. And they always believed that the team was bigger. They wanted people that would sacrifice for the team. They felt that that was the best way to have success, was in a team mentality, a team approach. And so that was ingrained in me watching them put a team together. Like when I started in Minnesota in 1990-91, they had gone there. Half of that team was going to go to San Jose the next year. But, you know, Bob Clark brought in Ilkka Senesalo and Brian Propp from Philly. Bob Gainey brought in Mike McPhee and Bobby Smith. You know, they brought in Mike Lawler. They brought in people that they knew over time that had those qualities. And all those qualities were the same. They were different personalities, but their qualities were the same, of competitiveness, of sacrifice. And then we move on, and then in Dallas I you know, we give up a top 10 pick and Todd Harvey to bring in Mike Keane and Mike Scrudland, and we don't win the cup without those guys. But they didn't have the sex appeal of Todd Harvey as far as draft status and all that stuff, but that was what we needed to win. And so what I've learned from them is you need different types of skill sets to win, but you probably only need the one skill set of character. Because without that, it doesn't matter how many goals you can score or how flashy you are. If you don't have that desire to go further, and I learned that from Kirk Muller, who was, again, a New Jersey Alba Montreal Canadian. And when he retired, I asked him about his career. And I said, like, you made the most out of your career. How did you do it? And he said, I just knew every night I was willing to go one inch further than the guy I was competing against. And some nights I had to go a foot, and some nights I had to go a mile. But I knew I was going to go one inch further, and that's the character I'm talking about. And so when I look back, I look at people that I admire, and they're the star players. I admire their talent, I admire their skill, their character. But it's the Mike Keens and the Scrudlands and the Mullers that really help drive a team. And I see that in a Brendan Morrow, I see that in a Jake Neighbors. You know, I see a lot of Mike Madonna and Robert Thomas together, great, great elite two-way players that help you win. I think there's so many different guys, but I think they all have that same characteristics, is their thirst to win.
Yeah. And then as far as spinning it forward, obviously this is your last season as general manager, stay on as president of hockey operations, Alexander Steen taking over. What do you hope to impart on him? I imagine they're not similar lessons that you took from Clark and Ganey, I'm just assuming they're a little different, but what kind of things would you like to impart?
Well, he's going to have his own vision on what his team wants to look like. What I want to impart on him is how to build the organization, not with the players. You handle that. How you build a scouting staff, how you build a coaching staff, how you build a analytics group, how you build that infrastructure are things that he shouldn't know. He's never been part of, you know, and you don't learn that in a day or a year or 2 years. You learn it over time. And I want to be able to impart on him the things that he doesn't have knowledge of. And as I'm doing that, he's sharing his knowledge of things I don't know, like what it was like to be drafted in the first round and then go in as an offensive player and then win a championship as a high character glue player that the coach counted on to do the right things all the time. Like that's about as big as gamut as you can find in the NHL. Yeah. And he did it. So I learned from him every day on things that he went through. And I expressed to him that those lessons, like he's fortunate. He can pretty well talk to everybody at his own level of, yeah, that happened to me too. Yeah, that happened to me too. And so I think that's important. And I can share to him contract things like I did his contracts. And he's seeing us do that. And he goes, I didn't know it went like that. And, you know, because you don't know what the player's being told by the agent on the demeanor, the how the conversation is going. And you can't really get hung up on that. But he sees all the work that Ryan Miller does behind the scenes to prepare. He sees how we're trying to go about doing it in a certain way. And he said, it's funny, you just, as a player, you just don't know that stuff's getting done behind the scenes. And I said, well, that's good. That's what you don't want the players worrying about that. Like you go back to the old, you know, owners own, managers, coaches coach, players play. And I said, when you're the manager, though, you have to be able to deal with the owner and understand what he wants. Then you have to be able to share your wisdom with the coaches and the players from your experiences. So you're really the center of the hourglass from the business of the hockey.
Yeah. So it seems like the hockey side is going to be the easy part. It's everything else that'll be new for him.
Right? I think the 7 to 9:30 to evaluate is going to be the easiest part for him. It's going to be everything else that is going to learn from experience, learn from observation, learn from Al McGinnis, learn from Scott Mellenby, learn from Peter Chiarelli, Tim Taylor, players, ex-players that were of his caliber that have seen management and asked lots of questions. And that's what one of the things that's exciting about Alex is how curious he is. Curious not only about hockey, about other sports, about business, how to connect and how to get people to get the best out of themselves. He's got a great curiosity about him, which I think is the bedrock to anything moving forward is your desire and willingness to try and get better and learn.
That was Doug Armstrong on the NetFront Presence podcast. Thank you so much, Doug.
Thank you very much.